Welcome into the All Ball Podcast. I'm Doug Gottlieb. And remember, you can listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show every afternoon, 3 to 6 Eastern Time, 12 to 3 Pacific. XM Sirius 203 and 217. Don't ask me which one. You can find it. We're on the same channel as Dan Patrick on Sirius XM. And of course, you can go to foxsportsradio.com. You can also download the Doug Gottlieb Show daily on iTunes, wherever you downloaded this podcast. Remember to, to download, subscribe, and to rate our podcast, because I don't think it helps me financially, but it helps my podcast ratings or whatever. And the downloads have been great. Listen, I'll leave the Final Four with this. There were 76,602 people. That was great basketball. Four amazing stories. I don't know how Auburn got to where they should have gone to the national championship without Chuma Okeke, but they probably should have, right? Virginia was the national champion coming from losing to Maryland Baltimore County to winning a national championship. Amazing. And then the way in which they won their last three games. Michigan State losing Josh Langford, losing two pros. Heck, Nick Ward getting hurt, and then winning the Big Ten tournament, beating Duke, going to a Final Four, and coming back and having a ball in the air down three, chance to tie the game late. Incredible. And then Texas Tech, who lost four starters. And like, I think the world of Chris Beard. I would only say this with Chris Beard, if I could make one change, I would have taken out Odiasi after he made the free throw to put him up three. I know they switched five all year long, but he gets beat. And then I don't know why Culver, you know, leaves the best player on the floor in the corner, open for a jump shot instead of giving up the easy two. They would have had a 1-point lead, but they're college kids. This happens. And I thought ultimately it cost them. Obviously, there were some calls that went the way of Virginia. I'm going to play for you something that you might find interesting. This was Tony Bennett on my radio show talking about a conversation he and I had after the college basketball season last year when they lost to Maryland Baltimore County. You bring up Key, and he did have a huge championship game, but I also think it speaks to you and your ability to read the game on the fly, because Kihei struggled a little bit with their size, with their length, and really they're just older guys, right? I mean, he's a kid. They're grown men. And I thought you made and they kind of changed their lineup. They went to a little bit of a small ball lineup, and it caused you to change. Was that part of your plan to play Key that much in the championship game, or is that something you felt as the game went on?
I felt that as the game went on, and Doug, I'm going to give you some credit. You and I had a conversation. You know, we go back so many years. You know, our fathers were both, you know, legendary coaches who've poured so much into us. And after last year's UMBC game, you know, you and I talked. I can't remember if we did an interview or not, but you talked. And you challenged me and encouraged me that, you know, obviously like everyone would grow from this game, but, you know, can you find ways when the tournament comes to play differently, even through the year, try different things, whether it's offensively or defensively or lineup-wise. And I remember that conversation, and I knew we had to do that because, you know, obviously – we were good last year, and DeAndre Hunter allowed us to play small. And then when DeAndre got hurt in the NCAA tournament, before that, we didn't have that four-guard lineup. Well, this year, when Braxton and Key got eligible, I knew at times we're going to be able to play Key as a five and Dre as a four or vice versa, and a real small lineup. And then against Purdue, we needed to go big with Salt and Momedy. So you kind of challenged me. We added some things, and I really tried to think hard about that, and I thought – in tournament runs, you need to be able to have the versatility to mix things up offensively or defensively. We used the offense against Texas Tech in the championship game that we hadn't hardly used all year because they ran a different kind of defense with the way they forced it on the side and switched. And so you have to have those things ready in those situations.
So, you know, look, I don't want to get into fouls. By the time you download this podcast, you probably forgot about the blow-by-blow, the play-by-play of different things. I will say this, and I'm sure I'm annoying to a lot of people who I'm friends with in college basketball. I text back and forth with, ironically, all four of these teams. I worked a little bit for Bruce Pearl. I know Steven really well. Dane Fife, who's going to be our guest and coach, is. I communicate with them often throughout the season. Tony Bennett, I don't communicate as much with, but we go way, way back. My dad, of course, was the coach at UW-Milwaukee. His dad's a Wisconsin legend. He's always been super kind to me. At some point, I'll have him on this pod, and we'll talk about how Klay Thompson became a Washington State Cougar. What am I forgetting? Oh, and then Chris Beard has two former Oklahoma State assistant coaches and head coach, Sean Sutton on the staff, and I've become pretty close with Coach Beard as well. So I know all of these guys. And so I'm probably annoying to them in that I do text them and call them and give you, I don't know, I'll give you my 2 cents. Sometimes another set of eyes is valuable. And I always tell them, like, hey, listen, if I don't know what I'm talking about, fine. But what I told Tony Bennett, what I encouraged Tony Bennett to do, I was like, look, I think your style of play is fine. I think you're going to get to a Final Four. I think you got a chance to win a national championship. But I think your percentage chances increase if you continue to add to your offensive repertoire. Remember, here's a guy who played overseas. Here's a guy who's playing the NBA. And it's not for lack of knowledge. It's just you can't simply depend on blocker mover and not have other tricks in the bag. They went to some ball screen continuity this year. They've put in more NBA sets. Of course, I think most of the college basketball world loves one of their elevator plays that they ran. But more than anything, I encouraged him, and this is just a general philosophy I have in life, but especially in sports, which is, hey, the goal of a team when they're preparing for you is to make you play left-handed, make you do something that you might be uncomfortable doing. And so, and oftentimes, coaches will fall back on, well, you know, it's just a bad matchup for us. It's just a bad matchup. That's what it was. We lost because it was a bad matchup. And that's reasonable. Sometimes there are certain styles, certain teams where you just don't match up well against. You know, you just got limitations based upon your personnel. That's going to happen. On the other hand, I remember I was covering, I don't want to tell you the team's name, but I was covering a team this year. And at the end of a game, they ran a play for a shooter, for a left-handed shooter. And he came off of it's one of those plays, I call it the nail. When you drive to the baseline, instead of throwing the hammer, you come back behind you, and the shooter from the top of the key comes to shoot the basketball. Well, they ran that play, and left-handed player, shot fakes, and even though to go to the right was open, he wanted to come back to a strong left hand. He went back to the defense. It wasn't as open. They lose the game. And so when I talked with the coaches afterwards, I was like, hey, just question, why didn't you run that to the other side of the court? And they're like, why? I was like, well, this particular player is left-handed. He likes curling off the screen, you know, moving to his left. And then if he shot fakes, he likes one dribble to his left. That's a 80% shot for him. He's like, well, we had never had that lineup in that position of a game to run that play. And I thought to myself, well, whose fault is that? Right? And again, this is the general philosophy I have, which is like, especially a coach like Tony. So this is what I told I know this sounds really arrogant. I didn't win him a national championship. I didn't tell him anything profound that he probably didn't already know and challenge himself. But this is a thought that I have, which is, you know, look, challenge yourself to sometimes create artificial adversity. Take a look at a different lineup. Take a look at guys at different spots, not just in practice, not just in scrimmages, not just in exhibition games, but in real games. Take a legit look at a small lineup. Take a legit look at a big lineup. Throw 3-point guards out there at once. Press. What does it all look like? Because you don't know in a one-and-done scenario or playing for your league championship how somebody's going to try and make you play or what type of matchup may ultimately expose what you normally want to do. And if you don't have a second gear or a third gear or if you don't have that, then what you do can become stale. And people spend all year figuring out, well, what do you do and how do we do it? They say, how do we stop them from scoring and how do we score against them? You know, I understand the pragmatism too. Hey, listen, I just want to win this game and I win this game. But sometimes you got to play the long game. You got to develop a bench. You got to develop a small lineup. You got to develop a big lineup. You got to develop a pressing lineup. You got to develop a, what do we do against the zone? And what do we do when we can't do that against the zone? Because my best shooter or my guy who's best in the high post, he's in foul trouble or he's sick or he broke a pinky finger or whatever. And so, yeah, I encouraged him to run more, some more ball screen stuff because, like Dane Fife is going to tell us, kids grow up learning to play off ball screens, and yet we're retraining them when they get to college to teach them how to play motion game at some of these schools. You got to sometimes play to some of their strengths. Tony did that. But I would readily admit I'm super annoying as a fan and a friend and a basketball guy to so many of these coaches, and I text them suggestions and things that I think, and we have long conversations. And generally, it's to continue to watch and evolve. And yeah, you always have your base. You always have your core ethics. You always have your offense. You always have your defense. But there are going to be times in which you got to change. I believe Bo Ryan would have won a national championship had he had a different way of playing the ball screen against Tyus Jones and Duke. But they always kind of flat hedged and sunk. And Tyus Jones hit jump shot after jump shot after jump shot. And people can tell me, well, it's the officiating with Duke. Like, no, it wasn't. Tyus Jones just made shots. Because Wisconsin played true pack line defense. And unlike Virginia, Virginia plays pack line principles, but they hard hedge ball screens. So that was my conversation with Tony Bennett. And you can hear that conversation in its entirety if you download it, part of the Doug Gottlieb Show. All right, let's get to our guest of the week. His name's Dane Fife. He's a longtime assistant at Michigan State. He's also a dear friend of mine. He was a tremendous player. Dad was a coach. Dad is a coach. And I just think his story is a really, really interesting one. And it kind of tells the story a little bit about Michigan State basketball this year. Okay, so let's start. I always love to do this. You grew up playing basketball where?
Wow.
Like did you have a park? There was a gym? Like, your first basketball memory is where?
Clarkston High School gym. My dad was a high school coach, and I just go to practice every day and shoot on the side all day.
Okay, so did the side hoops have fan backboards, or did they have wood backboards or regular glass backboards?
I grew up on glass backboards.
Oh, that's a nice gym right there to have side backboards that are nice glass square backboards. Your dad obviously a longtime coach. I mean, you even have a kid plays for you now who played for your dad. What's he like?
My dad?
Yeah, as a coach.
Well, he's nuts. He grew up in the post World War II era where the heroes were General Patton, Ike Eisenhower, the armies and the navies got a lot of good athletes. And so he was, favorite coach was probably at the time Coach Bob Knight. So I wouldn't say he was, he didn't use a lot of foul language or really yell and get in people's faces, but he was very structured, very organized, and he believed in playing with maximum effort every second you're out on the court. He always told me, "If I don't care what you play," I think he did care, but if you're going to play, you're going to do it your best, whether it's checkers or basketball, and he held me to that, and my brothers.
Now, your brother Dugan, just so you know, he not only, he has a better name than you, such a good name that it's memorable, right? And he played at Michigan, and, you know, growing up Doug, and Doug was like, you know, like the negative nicknames were like Doug Slug or Doug the Little Bug. And I was like, no, call me Dugan. Like, there was a time when I was like, actually, it's more Duke guy, go by Dugan. They're like, no, that's Dugan Fife. You're not Dugan.
Wow.
What's it like to have a, like, was he a nice big, my big brother, Greg, who's an assistant coach at Oregon State, he would vacillate between being an awesome big brother and a terrible big brother. I think sometimes that was the friends that he would keep, but like, hey, we're going to go meet at Jordan Elementary and shoot hoops, meet us there. And then I'd go there and there'd literally be nobody there, right? Just to get rid of me or lock me out of the house, pants me when we were in our friend's pool and throw my shorts up on the roof and then invite other people over. So what was your big brother like?
Rotten. And because I'm sure there's young people listening, I would say that probably until Dugan
went off to college. He was 6 years older than I was. He was probably the worst big brother that a little brother could have. And I was the baby, Jeremy, who's we're all 3 years apart. So Jeremy's the middle child, but Dugan was the worst big brother up until about his 19th birthday. Even then, he came home during mid-season in his freshman year at Michigan, and we were out shoveling off the basketball court in our backyard. It was just a small court. We shoveled it off, and I hit him in the lip on accident, playing him one-on-one, and he pushed me down and rubbed my face in the snow, and I was probably about 13 at the time, but there wasn't a day that I didn't plan to somehow make Dugan disappear in my youth.
It's awesome. If Coach Knight was your dad's hero, and it's interesting because I don't know if you know this, so my dad was a walk-on at Ohio State, a JV player, during the same era when Bob Knight was there, and they were kind of on-again, off-again friends, but he also looked up to Coach Knight, and although Coach Knight, I don't know, he didn't really recruit me. My dad never wanted me to play for him, not because of how he was, but more because of how he played. Like, that wasn't
right.
But why didn't Dugan go play for him?
Well, Dugan, my dad played at Michigan. He was with Rudy Tomjanovich and just after Cassie Russell, but my dad played at Michigan, and my dad played pro baseball with the Twins and then came back and was an assistant at Michigan. Ironically, he was on the bench when Michigan lost to Indiana in the 76 National Championship. And so when Dugan was young, Dugan was born in 74. He experienced Michigan basketball up close and personal. Mm-hmm. And so when he was young, 4, 5, 6 years old, until my dad stopped coaching at Michigan, those were his heroes. So, you know, that was ingrained in him when he was really young, and we always went to Michigan football games, Michigan basketball games. My dad was good friends with Bill Frieder, and so I think it was just a foregone conclusion that Dugan was going to go to Michigan. And there was never a doubt on anybody else, with exception to maybe Michigan State, maybe Stanford. I don't think that Indiana recruited him very hard, if you want the truth.
Okay. So then what about you? You're a big scorer in high school, right? And the respect that your dad had, because of your brother being a hell of a player, like, it wasn't, you were very heavily recruited. Why'd you go to IU?
Well, it's funny because the very first VHS tape that I ever watched, I remember getting our VCR when we were in 85 or late 1985.
Yeah, but remember you used to have to press the button down. You used to have to hold I don't know how you would consider those buttons, but you actually had to press the button down, right? The record button was always the last button you had to press down,
right? And then the remote control had a cord. So we did get one with a remote, but it had a cord.
Hmm.
So the very first VHS tape that I watched was Michigan versus Indiana for the Big Ten title. And this was Frieder versus Knight. I think Roy Tarpley was a senior. Steve Alford was a junior. But anyway, I just remember listening to Billy Packer and Brett Musburger talk about Bob Knight with such interest, and it was fascinating just how much they revered Coach Knight and his personality and Steve Alford. And Michigan ended up killing him, but it stuck in my mind. And then came the movie Hoosiers, and that represented everything that my hometown pretty much was. Small school, single school, just me and my friends just dream of winning a state championship. That was my dream, winning a state championship for my dad. And so, you know, either way, I think that Indiana started recruiting my sophomore year. Dan Dockich, ironically, was the first Indiana coach to start recruiting me. But it was just a dream of mine to, you know, when I was young, to just go play basketball at Indiana for Coach Knight. And Coach Knight, I viewed as was similar to my dad. His offense, his defense, his principles. My dad talked about him a lot. I felt like, you know, in an alternate universe, Dugan probably would have went and played for him too, if Michigan didn't exist, because Coach Knight represented what the game was to us: hard work, championships, doing it right. You know, there wasn't a lot of cheating going on in his program. It felt like we were just going to get an honest environment that was going to make you better. And that's ultimately what it was, even when I went there.
Okay, so you show up first day on campus at Indiana. What do you remember?
Well, my roommate was Luke Recker and Kyle Hornsby from Louisiana. Kyle Hornsby was he was a country boy, and Luke Recker was a sophomore. But the first thing that I saw was Coach Knight's silver Lincoln. It's the first thing I remember. And then moved into my apartment, and then we played open gym, and I was fearless, and here I am, a McDonald's All-American, thinking I'm really good, and what made me good is that I understood the game. I felt like I was way advanced, and you know that as a son of a coach, it's a blessing and a curse. You know, we are advanced, but then we think we know everything, and we're stubborn. Yeah. But I'd gotten where I was by playing hard, playing with effort, playing tough, and so the first day of open gym, I ended up squaring off with a 6'8", 235-pound, 23-year-old named William Gladness.
Yeah, we nearly got him at Oklahoma State. I mean, he was a junior college transfer. We nearly got him at Oklahoma State. We always man, we get William Gladness, we'll be all right.
Yeah, and I was always thankful that guys broke it up before there were any punches thrown, but I did was set a screen on him. Now, Will is who's passed away, but great guy. But interesting enough about Will is when you'd set a back screen on him, you know, screen him from behind,
You
had to be careful because he had a bullet lodged in his spine. And so apparently I'd hit that bullet. I'd hit something and turned around, and I said, gosh, that wasn't even as dirty as I could be, Will. But he said, you hit my bullet. So that was what I remember as my first day on campus, is the whole team ready to fight me out of the gate.
You guys had a pretty good team, right? You had Mike Lewis, you had Kirk Hastings.
We were loaded. We had a ton of talent. We just didn't defend it very well. We had first rounders. Luke Recker would have been a first rounder. He ended up transferring, as you remember, to Arizona and then to Iowa. Lewis, who's the all-time assist leader. AJ Guyton, who was an All-American. Kirk Hastings was a redshirt freshman my freshman year. We were a bit young. I mean, Lewis and Guyton were older, but we didn't have a group that we didn't have a great team. We had a lot of good parts. We just didn't have a great team. And I think because, unfortunately, there were a lot of agendas, not necessarily from the players, but from people who were attached to the players, that prevented us from really being a great team.
You guys lost in 2000 to Pepperdine, and I know that not just because I can read history, but I was there. It was in Buffalo. We thought we were going to play you, and I'd only played against Indiana once. I'll give you all my Indiana stories. I got one, Charlie Miller stayed at my house for a summer, maybe two summers. He obviously preceded you at IU. For people who don't remember, he's a wing, left-handed wing from Miami. He played for Frank Martin in high school. And so he played with us in AAU before he signed at Indiana. And So I went to the, what was it, the university? It was the under 18 and under 21, like university games teams or whatever, yeah. World Games team tryouts in Colorado yeah. Springs. And I met Brian Evans, and he told the greatest, most unbelievable Bob Knight stories. I mean, just had us howling, cackling, whatever. Anyway, then my freshman year, we get ready to play Indiana at Notre Dame. And the year before, Notre Dame had beaten Indiana in South Bend. And I think, don't hold me to this one because I haven't looked at the stats. I think they hit something like 15 threes, which at the time, like even now is a ridiculous number, but the time was yeah. unheard of. And as yeah. you know, Coach Knight was very, it wasn't until Texas Tech and late in his career where he embraced the three-point shot. And so he basically thought it was bullshit basketball, and he told everybody, you know, basically Notre Dame beat us on bullshit basketball. So we knew he was going to be pissed because he didn't forget a game. And IU had played UConn in the championship of the Great Alaska Shootout, and UConn kicked the dog piss out of him, beat him by like 40, right? So we go down, and they hadn't played in like a week. They got back from Alaska, and I'm sure they practiced like five times a day, right? He probably kicked them out of the locker rooms and some shit like that. And we go down, and the night before, they had just put a new court down in the arena, okay?
Uh-huh.
In what is it, Alumni Hall, whatever? So they just put Assembly Hall, I'm sorry. There's two Assembly yep. Halls, right? There's Illinois yep. and IU. So Assembly Hall. And so we go in, and like, if you've been, and I know it's been redone, it's beautiful now. It wasn't yep. beautiful then, but it was just, it was gigantic. It was the biggest arena I had ever been yep. in at that point in time in yep. my life. It's like our first road game ever. And the court was springy as hell, and everybody yep. is throwing down. Bam, bam, yep. bam. We're like, man, we're going to be good. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. We're going to be that good. So the things I'll never forget about Coach Knight is you're warming up. And everybody, you're looking down the other end, and there's the candy stripe pants, and there's IU. Damn. And the band is playing. You're like, damn, I'm playing Indiana on national TV. Holy shit. And then out walks Bob Knight. And I had met him a couple times before, but you forget, he's a big ass dude, right? He was like, I don't know, 6'3", 6'4", and he had the red sweaters, and then, you know, all the fans have they want to be Bob Knight's had the red sweaters. And then he would always he never came out by himself. He already had a couple dudes with him, right? He rolled deep for a coach.
He had his cronies. He'd have his cronies.
Yeah. So he comes out and like literally everybody stops. Like we're in layup lines and dudes stop and look and like there's Coach Knight. You know, silver hair, and he comes by and he shakes John McLeod's hands and he goes sit down, whatever. And you're like, it was at basketball royalty at that time. So
it's
we're down 40. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
We're down 40-14 at the half. And I never forget, like, you go running off the court and you go right by the band and they're playing the fight song, right? Mm-hmm. And then the last part of the fight song is, "Are you?" And like the whole place is shaking. And the student section is going, "Don't come out. Don't come out. Don't come out." And I remember going to the locker room going like, you know, guys, they say we don't have to come out in the second half. Like, we're cool. We're good. So here's the story I tell people all the time. So what was the big dude's name from Texas? Shit. Who was a junior at the first name.
Andre Patterson.
Huh? Andre Patterson.
Andre Patterson, yeah.
Right. So we get our ass beat, and I play okay. We go down back to South Bend. I roll into my dorm at Dillon Hall, and I flip on ESPN. And it's right about to hit, like, the SportsCenter. It goes, dun, 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 dun. Are you ready for SportsCenter? Dun, 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 dun. So in somewhere in the second half, I had driven in and tried to shoot a floater over Andre Patterson. Part of it was probably a little bit of a weak floater. Part of it was at Indiana, so it was goaltending, I feel, wasn't called. And part of it is, if you've been to Assembly Hall, you know they have like three rows of stands that are low, and then there's the wall, and then there's the second, and then there's the second level, and then the third level is so far out there, I don't even know how you see the floor.
Right, right.
He didn't block my shot. He caught my shot, and I felt like threw it in the direction of John Cougar Mellencamp, who was sitting there close.
Yep.
And it was to add insult to injury, when he caught the ball and threw it out of bounds, he goes, "No!" Right? So I get back, right? Remember, like, grew up dreaming of like, love Bob Knight, dreaming of playing maybe a four against Bob Knight. My dad has notes, copious notes from West Point of going to his, you know, telling stories about his jump shot was called the Blue Dart when he played at Ohio State. Like, I know everything about Bob Knight. And we catch an ass whooping by like 40 at IU. And are you ready for SportsCenter? No! And there's my shot. My floater. You see 44 from Notre Dame, Gottlieb, and Andre Patterson's face laughing as he throws a shot in the direction. That's my IU story. Anyway, go ahead.
You were the lead.
I was the lead. They did not bury the lead. That's anyway, you were saying about Coach Knight, the thing that stuck out about you.
Well, you mentioned how big he is. And when I was, I committed to Indiana, okay, and then he came up to visit me sometime late fall, and we were still in football season. May have just finished, but we're making the transition to basketball season. But I was a football player, too, and it's probably my first love. But I had interest in playing QB at Indiana. Cam Cameron was the coach at the time. And I said, Coach, you know, I'm coming. Back then, if you signed in the November early period, you couldn't play football that fall. But if you signed in the late period, then you could. Weird rule. But I said, I'd like to sign in the spring so I have an option of playing football. And there was just dead silence. He looked at the ground. He looked up. He pulled up he always wore elastic band pants. I remember noticing that. But he pulled up a chair. And he lifted his pant leg up to his knee, and he said, you see these pants? You see this leg? Yeah, Coach. You see this calf? Now, that's a damn football calf. I'm a football player. This is a football leg. Now, look at your scrawny legs. I said, yep. I said, I tell you what. You come to Indiana, you're coming to play basketball. And that's it. And I looked at my dad, who was in the athletic director, my coach at the time. He didn't have much to say. Kind of left me out to dry. I said, okay, sounds good, Coach. So, needless to say, I signed in the early November signing period. But I remember that leg. He was definitely the leg of a tight end. Maybe a defensive tackle, but he was a big fella.
So you get beat by Pepperdine. That was his last game as head coach. What was it like to be a player during what was just a crazy, turbulent time at IU? Because again, like the lens we look at Coach Knight now is so different than the various lenses of his time at Indiana. Like 80s, early 90s, like. He would have run for governor unopposed. Even
in any state?
Exactly. But at Indiana, I mean, you went like outside of Purdue fans, like 99% of people are going to vote for Coach Knight. Obviously, he wasn't viewed the same, but like you guys still had good players and you still had good teams. And then all of a sudden, the Neil Reed video appears and the interviews and all that stuff that went bad. What was that? What do you remember about that time?
Well, I always tell people now, you know, mostly that when you catch Coach Knight in his worst moments, they're usually in a game. And that's the big stage. But behind the scenes, and I'd say for the most part being 80%, very complimentary in practice. Pretty easy to work with in practice. His frustration was all about effort. When there was a problem, it was usually about effort. Wasn't about a turnover, a missed shot. It wasn't about anything that you could control. Yeah, you couldn't control. And so, mostly complimentary. But they put the zero tolerance on him, okay, in the spring. They, as in the administration, I don't have any problem with that. You know, if you got a problem with somebody, you got to deal with it the way you see fit. Now, was it fair or not fair? I don't know, but they did. So we roll into early September, and I remember on the I woke up Sunday morning, And my roommate had called, and he said, hey, they're going to fire Coach Knight. So this was after he grabbed a student's arm and addressed, told him to call him Mr. Knight or Coach Knight. But so we drove up to Indianapolis for the trustee meeting. President Brand announced that he was firing him. And it was funny because we drove back to Bloomington, and Ed Werder came over to our house from ESPN. Met with us. Andy Katz, I remember Andy Katz. I still, to this day, talk to Andy Katz about that day. Andy Katz was there. There were just, there were so many things, and then the students march on the president's house at the time. And I walked over to that just to see what was going on, and it was chaos. I mean, you'd think there was a coup going on, and to see the passion and the anger and the frustration that people had for this figure was incredible. And I know myself and my teammates. I remember being in the locker room, Jared Jeffries, Sunday night when Coach Knight came back, thanked Coach Knight. And I remember Coach Knight going into a little area outside the locker room, and I overheard him tell a friend of his that he couldn't face us, as in, I can't do this. I don't want to have to face these guys. I don't want to leave them. And you're able to see Coach Knight vulnerable. You're able to see how much we mattered, how much the school mattered. And right or wrong, it was his time. He left. But it was pretty emotional, because a lot of us had dreamed of growing up and playing for that man, whether it was Indiana or not. That was my dream, and I was upset. I was frustrated, but it was a pretty surreal time for a bunch of 18 to 22-year-old kids that didn't know which end was up anyway.
Okay, so what happened? Did you guys get together? Because I just think the leadership of that moment is fascinating. And like, obviously, if it was today, you guys would all be in the transfer portal. But that it wasn't that way then. And somebody had to have dudes over. Like, I heard a story, Brian Evans, I never forget the story that, you know, one year he kicked him out. He would always kick you guys out of the locker room, put all your shit in the hallway, right? And they wouldn't have practice, but you're supposed to run practice on your own. Then his wife would come down and talk to Coach Knight, loves you guys. Like, it was just one of the things that he would do. But that sometimes in order to get away, you know, they'd go to a manager's house, and all the players would hang out together. And there was some tape, and you tell me if this is real. There's some tape of Coach Knight getting run over in practice, where, you know, you're transitioning from offense to defense, and he forgot, and he got caught up in the whitewash, and he's like, man, I'm telling you, when we'd have a bad day, we'd go to a manager's house, and we'd watch that tape over and over and over again of him getting run over and laugh our ass off. So what do you remember about, like, how'd you, because you guys stayed together and you end up going to a Final Four. I know everybody right. didn't stay. How did it play out?
Well, I was transferring back to Michigan State, and I went over to Coach Knight's maybe Monday. So he got fired on September 10th, so probably September 11th or 12th. I remember being in his kitchen and just saying, Coach, look, if they're not keeping the rest of the staff, then I'm going to go, because I don't want to play for a new staff. And we'd heard rumors of different coaches coming in, and you know, I wasn't sure what was going to happen with the rest of the team in terms of who's coming and going. A lot of us said we were going to transfer. I think some of them were bluffing. I, at the time, wasn't, because I was okay. I was at peace with Coach Knight being removed, but I didn't want to lose the rest of the staff, that being Mike Davis and John Treloar. Pat Knight was the other assistant. I assumed he was leaving. So Coach Knight seemed to think that they weren't going to retain Mike Davis, or who's at University of Detroit now, or John Treloar, who's a scout with Phoenix. Coach Knight didn't think they were going to retain them either, so he said, well, help me transfer. And it's funny because there's so many coaches that come up that have come up over the years that Coach Knight actually reached out to. And but I said, can you help me transfer? And he said, you sure this is what you want to do? And I said, yeah, I don't want to be a part of a new staff, and I'm not sure who's going to stay, and it doesn't really matter. You know, I don't want to be here if you, part of you, I don't want to change things. So, you know, I went back, I left right away and announced I was transferring. Meanwhile, Jared Jeffries comes up to me and says, well, hey, you know, I'm hearing that they might keep Mike Davis, Coach Davis, and Coach Treloar, and let them do an interim. Just like, oh, man. So long story short, I decided I was going to stay, and Kirk Haston stayed, and Jared Jeffries was a freshman that year. Tom Coverdale, we had a really good core group that, you know, over the course of 2 years became a damn good team, even though Haston left. It was funny because Haston was really instrumental in me staying. And not that I mattered. I averaged 5 points a game, but, you know, I was just a vet, and they needed some vets. But Haston went pro after that year, and Haston was the one that talked me into staying. And said, we're going to win a national championship in the next 2 years. And so when Haston left, I didn't speak to him for a whole summer. But I guess looking back, if you got a chance to be drafted, I think he was 15 or 16 to the Charlotte Hornets. Probably should have left. But, yeah, we had a good core group. Jared Jeffries, Coverdale, Kyle Hornsby, Jared Odell. I don't have any stories like Brian Evans does about rallying over the our coach getting run over, but I do think that you know, we rallied on Coach Knight's behalf, and because he was still important to us and still is, and you combine that with Coach Davis and John Treloar putting us in positions to succeed. It was a great recipe, but the other thing it was some guys that were committed to winning, committed to Indiana.
If you could, the three things, give me three things that Coach Knight taught that you believe in to this day.
You know what? I think that even as I work for Coach Izzo, the one thing you can't allow as a coach is a bad practice. And a bad practice from a team, but it usually starts from somewhere. Does it start from your leadership amongst your players? Does it start from a player, or does it start where does it stem from? And Coach Knight would never let up. It was a relentless pursuit of excellence. And if there was a bad practice from a player, he dealt with it. He dealt with it in a way that would typically make sure that it wouldn't happen again. And so there was no let up. And I remember being in practice, and it was like a trance because you had to be focused. You had to be intense. You had to know what you were doing. And when practice ended, it was... it wasn't relief, but it was, what did I just do for the last 2 hours? Because of that, you know, for a 21 or 18 to 22-year-old to maintain focus for that 2 hours, for that long period of time, is, I don't think it could happen today. And it barely could happen back when I played in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah, it's interesting because we used to, our practices were long, and I'd never forget. Mm-hmm. So the old Gallagher Iba used to have a clock behind the stands in one of the end zones. And remember, this is a 6,300 seat gym. It's not really an arena, but there used to be a clock, and guys would, you know, they're huffing and puffing. They'd look up, and we didn't condition, you know, coaches thing, you know, occasionally during Christmas break, we'd do some running, and we do running as punishment, but we never did conditioning. Right. When I was at Notre Dame, I thought John McLeod had an interesting way of doing conditioning. He had 4 quarters of practice. And after at the end of every quarter of practice, you would do a conditioning drill or two and then get water. That's how he did it. Mm-hmm. Whereas Coach Sutton, like, we never did any conditioning. And his whole thing was like, you can make it through my practice, you can make it through a game. and I never forget, like, you'd be on your shorts and guys would start looking up. And we would, part of the problem was we had a bunch of, and I think you guys are the same thing, we had a bunch of smart asses.
Yep.
And, you know, you get to like 2.5, 3 hours and be like, 20 hour rule, right? And, coach would, without any quay, happen a couple of times the year where he'd tell late Pat Noyes, one of the guys, his snake who died in a plane crash. Mm-hmm. He'd go, Snake, you go up there, you cover up that clock. You got a bunch of clock watchers here. You got a bunch of clock. Yeah. We came here to work. We came. This is the hardest thing you're going to do in life. You cover up that damn clock. And sure enough, there'd be like a white sheet over the clock. And guys are trying to like look through the white sheet like, man, I think we've been here 3 hours, man. Fuck this. We got to get out of here. Right. But it's really amazing because now if, and I don't know what you, and we used to make fun of Kansas because Kansas, you know, they would dial back their practices a bunch. That was Roy Williams' thing, was like, fresh legs, man. Yep. They go like 45 minutes an hour when they get to February. And mm-hmm. Coach, he wasn't having any of that shit. And but now I do think you're better off going twice a day for an hour and 15, hour and a half, just because guys' attention spans aren't that long, let alone coaches' attention spans aren't that long.
Well, that's right. And I'd say this, too. There's a lot more for head coaches to have to do now than there was. And, you know, whether it's recruiting, alumni, media, and don't forget about your own family. You just wonder how a guy like Coach Izzo or Coach K processes things throughout the day. I mean, but I'd say the other thing that I won't forget is we would always wonder what kind of mood Coach Knight was in each day. Yeah. It always varied. And it could be, there were so many different spots on the spectrum that he could be, but being in this business now, I think it was just his way of not allowing us to be comfortable and finding things to keep us on our toes, which isn't out of the ordinary in sports or the working world, I don't think. I think good bosses find ways to keep people motivated without driving them away. And those that understand that get better. Those that don't, look for excuses. But there were so many different personalities. I mean, you talk about split personality, it just multiple splits. But I think looking back, it's probably, you know, the old method to his madness. And then the third thing was a lot of people. I mean, when you think of Coach Knight, you think of motion offense, right?
Right, right. I think people do, but there was different types of motion, right? You guys would have, you know, you'd have the baseline runner, you'd have the triangle, right? There was a couple different types, but go ahead.
Yep. I think, you know, we didn't have out-of-bounds plays either. Just guys figured it out. But the attention to detail on the defensive end, I think, where Coach Knight was his best. And I think the motion was just a toy. I mean, motion allowed him to coach defense more. And, you know, I argue with Coach Izzo all the time, you know, whenever he talks about how they used to whip us. I said, now keep in mind, Coach, I was 4-4 against Michigan State while I was at Indiana. And he'll even make the comment, well, you know, you guys were motion and you were hard to prepare for, but did you guys prepare that much on defense? And I said, well, Coach, there's a reason why we beat you, the mighty Michigan State. I mean, and that's because it's pretty similar to what we do here. But I'd say that he doesn't get enough credit. Coach Knight doesn't get enough credit for his defensive preparation and the way his teams defended. Now, in his later years, they struggle. There's a lot of turnover in players, and I don't think he was getting the players that he really needed to. But the defense is something that's underrated as I look back on Coach's career.
Okay, so we did, I guess, force baseline. We did post to post double. We worked on we call it ceiling, where we would seal off the lane. You drove baseline, you come over and help and take a charge, and trap that. And then whoever was guarding the ball, you were the rotate man, or you were the flyer, right? And we'd work on scramble drill. And out of a double team in the low post when the ball is reversed, scramble as well. But I'll never forget, again, one of my first practices at Oklahoma State, I said, hey, Coach, which way are we forcing him? And he's like, what do you mean? I was like, well, are we forcing baseline, are we forcing middle? He's like, neither. I was like, no, Coach, like, where's the help? He's like, college man should guard his man. I was like, all right, Coach, that's great. But if he happens to go by me, which way would you prefer that he goes by me? To the baseline or to the middle? I was like, neither. He goes by you. The only place you're going is to sit next to me and help me coach, right? It was a little simpler then, right? Like, we did have inbounds plays, but and I've talked about this. Miles Simon joined me last week on the pod, and he was like, dude, we had three plays. Like, Lute never brought up a whiteboard. Coach Sutton never drew on a whiteboard or whatever. I understand. Mm-hmm. But you guys did help to the middle, right? Was the help from the middle or the help from the – because, like, the players kind of – and the assistant coach is like, well, what Coach really wants is, like, you don't want you – but, all right, we're going to help from the baseline. It was almost like whispering, you know? What was the general defensive philosophy that was so good?
It was baseline, and it was funny because it changed right around that era to me. A lot of it was middle, and then it just had changed to baseline probably somewhere in the mid-90s, or I'm sorry, late 80s, early 90s. Before that, I don't think there was defense. You know, I listened to my dad talk about when he played in the 70s. He said, we didn't have defensive principles. Guard your man and do a good job.
Yeah, that was Eddie Sutton right there.
I want you to
turn his ass to the glass. Excuse me? When we were at Arkansas, and we had the triplets, and Marvin Delph and Alvin Robinson, and they would get into you when you crossed midcourt, and we wanted to make that point guard turn his ass to the glass, brother. You can guard like that, you can play for me. Anyway, yeah, there wasn't any like, hey, how are we playing this ball screen? Like, are we gonna ice it? Are we gonna trap it? Like, no, you guard your man.
Yeah. That's right.
Okay,
don't let your man score.
Yes, that's generally good. That's good coaching,
hey,
right there.
You know what? I always give my dad crap about going against Rick Mount. He denies he had to guard him, but Rick Mount got 52 against him, against Michigan, and beat him. And that's without the three point shot. How does that happen? How does a guy score 52 points without the 3 point shot in the college?
Have you ever seen Rick Mount shoot a basketball?
Yeah, but you think Rick Mount would do it in today's game?
Yeah.
See, I don't, and that's not to say that Rick Mount wasn't incredible. But, I mean, defense today is a lot different.
I'd agree. But like, listen, I remember going to Final Fours, and Rick Mount would do shooting clinics, and I was like, Dad, does he ever miss? And he's like, nope. I mean, it was unbelievable. And then you add in the 3 point line. Oh, okay. So, what do you remember about the Final Four playing in it?
Well, I remember the flag. Okay. This was the year of 9/11, and it's 2002. And I remember the flag. Okay. And it was a lot bigger. And that's the flag that's flying on the World Trade Center, near the World Trade Center. And it had the burn marks, and you could smell it. And they had the firefighters and policemen that were at Ground Zero. And it was as powerful as being in the presence of Coach Knight. Or it was an incredible rush. And otherwise, you know, we were there to win the game, the games, and again, it's for guys that we had a lot of juniors and seniors. The intensity, the focus, there wouldn't, aside from my kids being born, there's not a better moment. There's not a bigger rush. There's not a bigger, a better time. You know, the 18 to 20s, you always hear people tell stories, the older people, about the good old days.
Yeah.
You know, my grandpa, 92, passed away, but his 18, 19, 20s, World War II, Normandy. Other grandpa, Philippines. You know, just the time when you were young, you were out from under the umbrella of your parents, and it was just an incredible time. And in the Final Four, it was in Atlanta that year, and you know, there were a lot of great stories that came from it, but ultimately, Doug, I think you remember the smiles it put on people's faces. And I don't remember much from the games, but the smiles that we put on people's faces, especially Indiana, that was reeling from the Coach Knight firing, we gave the people, from a sports perspective, from a basketball perspective, something to smile about. We probably weren't supposed to be there. I think we were a 4 seed that year. We beat Duke, who had 8 first rounders.
That's, you know, crazy. Insane. But,
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, they had 8 first rounders. We had 1 CBA draft pick. That was me. So I guess you could say we had 1 first rounder, right?
Yeah.
CBA.
Yeah, listen, I was USBL number 1. I was in first overall pick of the USBL.
What team?
Oklahoma City. Oklahoma Storm. Enid, Oklahoma. Number 1 overall pick. A lot of fighting for that pick. They traded up. There was at least one ball bag that was exchanged. Huh?
You and Chris Webber, same thing in common.
Yeah.
Both first round picks. But you know, you see those smiles and just an incredible time.
Okay, so how about this one? You did fix your shot or look, you had a little bit of the same thing I had, only you fixed it by the end of your college career. I couldn't, right? Like, you were a big scorer, Mr. Basketball, mm-hmm. State of Michigan. Everybody wanted you. And then you couldn't make a shot in college until your senior year when, again, like now, you'd probably shoot twice as many threes, but you became nearly a 50% three-point shooter, and you actually became a threat. How did you fix it?
You know what? There's a ton of variables that go into that, but I think I first had to understand a couple things. One, the physiology of it. What's happening to – I mean, I Mike Davis, one of my favorite people on earth, took over for Coach Knight when he was fired, coaching at Detroit. Used to call me Quarter Till, and Quarter Till just meant when the lights turned on, I was great until the lights turned on and it was game time. Not out of the ordinary for a young player. And A.J. Guyton used to call me the practice All-American. He says I was the best practice player in the country. And then the lights turned on. And you know what? It's choking. You're choking. I like to look at it as over-caring and put too much pressure on myself. But to understand the physiology component, like what is happening to your body, I would find myself so worked up before the game, so nervous about not doing what I was capable of doing, so frustrated, so anxious that I would be exhausted before the game. And, you know, it would just manifest itself into everything. It'd be dribbling. It'd be anything that involved the small muscles. The little muscles in your fingers, your arms, anything that would affect the small muscles, the finesse muscles, similar to what would affect a pitcher or a quarterback. You know, the big muscle things like running and staying in a defensive stance, and it didn't involve the finesse part of it, I was fine, but it was small things. And so Now, what did I do to change it my senior year? I'd always worked on my shot. I'd always worked on my game. A lot of shots, a lot of time outside of practice. I'd like to say I just stopped caring, but I didn't stop caring. I just think that you never know when it's going to click, and you've got to put in the work, but it just finally clicked. And I think part of it was just better perspective, just having better perspective. But the other part was I'd seen every psychologist, talk to every coach, talk to every person you could think of to try to gain that perspective. But I think ultimately it was just the pressure went away after I decided that the game was important, but it wasn't my life, and it didn't define me. And there were breathing techniques, and there were different things that you could do, but it didn't define me. And
how often you've been a coach now for your entire professional life? You did 1 year of hoop, and then how often do you see this occurring, where you have guys with what I think the layman would term a performance anxiety?
I would say that everybody has some degree of it. And the best example I can give you is something that I know you struggled with, and that was free throws. And so if you take somebody in the game at the free throw line versus what they shoot in practice, it always is different. It's always different.
My deal was, so I'll tell you quick kind of psychology. Sorry to interrupt. Mine started to manifest itself in high school, very late at the free throw line. And mm-hmm. I was a big scorer. And I never forget, we were playing at the Pond in Anaheim, which is now the Honda Center, playing Dominguez, who I lost to my junior year and my senior year. They were loaded. Tayshaun Prince and Tommy Prince. Tayshaun was just like a freshman. Tommy Prince and Kenny Bruner, like they had a squad. And I remember getting to the free throw line in the Pond, and I had always been like, end of the game, hold the ball, get fouled, make free throws, right? And like I just all of a sudden felt off. Felt like this is not where I'm supposed to be. And then I went to Notre Dame, and I was 160 pounds. And I mean, I was cocky as shit. Like I'm going to be starting point guard. We started like lifting, and we were, taking it back then. Creatine was big, whatever. And I don't know what water weight or whatever. But by the time we got to our first game, I was 177 and I was yoked, right? Man mm-hmm. muscles, 19, yoked. But I felt like my body was tight, and I felt like I felt heavier. And suddenly I went from being able to dunk to like, all right, now I'm like nicking the rim, and mm-hmm. and that hurt me. And then I was a little bit, your freshman year, like I was a little lost offensively.
Yep.
Now for me, the free throw thing became kind of it wasn't until I got really to Oklahoma State where it manifests itself to any shooting, where I just had a fear of failure. And so I wouldn't shoot, and I would, I also remember, I remember, like, I was the opposite. I could do anything on a basketball court. I mm-hmm. just couldn't get myself to actually shoot like I can normally shoot,
Right.
And then it become like a self-fulfilling prophecy where I wouldn't believe it was going to go in, so it wouldn't go in. And so you take it, and it would look bad shooting, and it would get worse, and then you'd feel bad.
Yep.
And it was really, I mean, I don't know how you feel about your first 3 years in college. Like, I've never shown my son a tape of me playing college because I'm so embarrassed by how people guarded me, because I'm like, of course I can fucking shoot, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's so hard. And I was as good as I was. And I also had a coach that didn't know how to coach me. Like, I love Eddie Sutton, but he didn't understand what was going on with me mentally, where I just needed somebody to go like, hey dude, you miss it? Don't worry about it. You're not taking bad shots. Yeah. Get your ass back on defense. But instead he'd take me out. And then I never wanted to come out. I felt like coming out of a game was punishment. And so I was just like, shit, if I don't shoot, then he's not going to take me out, and then I'm good. Yeah. Whereas all the guys on my team are like, shit, take the shot. You missed. Don't worry about it. He's going to put you back in. And I just couldn't get over that mental hurdle.
Yeah. Well, it is. It's a case of just you're over-caring. And it's funny because mine started in high school, too. And it started at the free throw line. I shot an air ball, and then next thing I know, the crowd's yelling air ball on it. Whatever. So then I got to the point, whatever you do, don't air ball. So then I'm just hoping and praying it hits the rim as the year went on, and it was my sophomore year. And we lost a chance at a state championship because of it. And, you know, if I could pinpoint exactly why, and I could look back in, like, sixth and seventh grade and say, gosh, I could make free throws better than I could in college in seventh grade. And so, you know, the pressure gets to everybody. There's varying degrees. I kind of look at it as three types, you know. So the worst one, and baseball is an easy one to look to, would be the Steve Sachs or the Chuck Knobloch, or the guy that's going through it right now is the pitcher John Lester. And what I'm for the Cubs, and I think he's still with the – no, I think he left.
Yeah.
Who's he with now? Still with Cubs?
I don't know, but he got to where he could actually kind of throw it to first base. But
right, but it'd be underhand. It'd be something awkward. And
yeah.
I was surprised, and I think you agree with this, that it didn't spill into his pitching.
Nope.
And
lean to throw into first base.
Right. And so the fascination of it, that would be the worst, though, where Steve Sachs or Chuck Knobloch, or you remember Rich Ankiel for the Cardinals, watched it unfold before my eyes when he was pitching against the Braves. I think it was the NLCS. And he just went to hell right in front of us. And he ended up coming back as a hitter, but was an elite pitcher. And so there's those, but I think most players spend their pressure, you know, they're in the middle area of if they could just get over the hump as far as dealing with the pressure, they would be elite. They would be pros. You know, and then there are the pros that really can handle the pressure. But, you know, Shaq, for example, okay? In my opinion, Shaq didn't miss. Shaq couldn't hit a free throw because of what you and I had to deal with. Yeah, he had big hands. Yeah, he had long arms. Yeah, he was 7'1", 330. But I think it was completely in his head where most people say, yeah, no, he shot 38% because his hands are too big. You know, he's worked with every coach. You know, a golfer, you know, the things that involve those finesse muscles like pitching and shooting, it's delicate. And the mental psyche is delicate. And that's why there's so few great pitchers. I always like to say if every pitcher were that threw 96 mile an hour could put it where they want it, then we wouldn't have Greg Maddux, Doug, and that's the truth. I mean, there would be no room for 88 mile an hour fastballs, 86 mile an hour fastballs, if you could put it where you want it. But the fact of the matter is, you can't because of the mental psyche. It's just hard to be elite. And I think that's the fascination is why did it happen to you and I? Why did it happen to Steve Sachs? Why did it happen to Shaq?
Yeah. Chuck Knobloch and John Lester. Why do you think, why do you think, I'd like to think it's a sign of intelligence. Right. That you think too much, that you think about the ramifications of it.
Yeah.
You know, I would say that would be my thing is I just overthought it. Joe Crispin, who you played against, I know. Joe Crispin has a saying. He's now a D3 coach.
Oh yeah,
and his brother. And Joe was a great shooter, and I never forget. He was like, "Hey man, you think you stink? Just remember that.
Yeah.
You think you stink."
Yeah.
And I just couldn't. I never thought about a single pass I ever had to make. I never thought about anything else. I, like, you know, all these guys, like my son was, hey, dad, did you crossover, go behind your back? I was like, no. I would try and go by somebody, and if they would beat me to a spot, I would spin or I'd cross over or go behind my back or something like that. I just react to it. Like, I didn't do all this other one-on-cone bullshit. But I didn't have to, you know, whereas you see little kids and they're like thinking moves. Like, who thinks about a move?
Yeah.
But I would get up there and I would start thinking. And, you know, I think, you know, as I've gone on now as a dad and trying to teach as a coach and it's what I think the proper way to teach things is to teach process as opposed to result, which is like, hey, worry about your feet and your breathing and your hands and just don't even worry about the ball going in. Because the more if your feet are right, you know, if you just worry about these little things, your feet are right, your hands right, it'll go in more times than not. I think that's the way. Okay, so let me fast forward here because your time is precious. You become a head coach at 25 years old at Indiana Purdue Fort Wayne. What was that like?
You know, once again, being the son of a coach, you know, the basketball component was easy. Teaching it came natural. I think what you can't get a head coach, much less a 25-year-old, to understand is that this is a serious business. And they're, you know, just like the financial world or, you know, the movie business. This is a serious business, and there are a lot of there's a lot of good people, and then there's a lot of people that will are looking for the easy way. And growing up the way I did, I assume you're the same way, especially in sports. Small town, you're not really exposed to. I wasn't exposed to, you know, the bad parts of humans, you know, that where there's the selfish part of it, the selfish part of the world, the greedy part of the world, and so at 25. I'm just thinking, look, if I'm just honest, if I'm just kind, if I'm just do things right, like Coach Knight did, I'll be great. And it just wasn't the way it worked. In what way?
I mean, like, listen, like, this is a long way removed from it.
Yeah.
But in what way? Well, like, give me an example.
The way it changed me. I went into it as a 25-year-old with a very open-minded, naive part of it being so young, but just believing in people with the utmost degree of respect and honesty and integrity, because that's all I'd ever been around and exposed to. And part of it was my choice. You know, going to Indiana, I was around a lot of great people. Part of it was just being in a family and a town that had great leadership and great people. And so I entered a world of there's millions to be made. And there's a lot of money in at stake. And then you've got to deal with a lot of good parents, but many delusional parents and coaches and mentors and a lot of different agenda. So essentially I entered the real world, and the real world can be unforgiving. And so as a 25-year-old navigating the running with the wolves was a big shock. So an example would just simply be scheduling. And I didn't understand that you couldn't just play Michigan State and lose. because you and I were brought up as, hey, let's play these teams to get better.
Right.
You know, so I was excited about those opportunities. I didn't care about my record at that time. And the more I was told and that, look, you got to get wins. You got to get this. You got to get that. I said, well, hey, look, let's get our players better. I would say that the recruiting world is, even at that level, is difficult.
In what way?
Because of everybody thinks they're a pro.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the amazing part, right? It's like, listen, do you know Indiana, Purdue, Fort Wayne? And by the way, like, people obviously Google. You're terrible. Like, your last year, you were 18-12 at IPFW. That's amazing. That's amazing in Division I basketball, considering the number of guaranteed games you had to play, the resources, the fact that, like, you're not even the most famous IUPU, right? Like, IUPUI,
that's right.
Uipui was much more, like, wait, what? Purdue, Fort Wayne? What the hell?
It was funny because I had an assistant named Jeff Tungate, who's the head coach of the Oakland University women. But he was an assistant, and he was my assistant, and he was at Division II school. And when he came in on day one and saw our budget at IPFW, who was transitioning from D1 or D2 to D1, we weren't in a league. He said, you're funded. I got bad news. You're funded like a bad, bad Division II team. And
go ahead. Sorry.
And he said, the chances of us getting 10 home games out of 29 or 30 at the time is going to be really difficult. And he said, you want worse news? He said, you're starting 0-5 out of the gate. I said, what do you mean? He goes, we got to play 5 bye games. And of the so many that were played last year, let's say there were 250 bye games that were played last year. He said, three teams won a bye game. So you start out 0-5. And then the tough part was just getting games, and even more difficult than that was getting home games. But, that said, that the building part, we finally got into a league eventually. And you said 18-12. There, it was funny because the year I left, we were 18-12. And that was the year that Michigan State lost to UCLA in the first round. I said, I think we were 18-12, and I think Michigan State was 19-12. I said, they're having a parade for us in Fort Wayne, and they're ready to fire Izzo in East Lansing. And that gives you some perspective. I said, we finished third in our league. Might even finish second. I don't remember. But, Michigan State, we finished third in the Big Ten. We may be a 3 seed. You know, and I'd say 18 at the mid to low major level because of bye games.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
That's as good as any 20-game high major.
More than 20. I mean, you can, 20 wins. I don't know if you know this, but over 100 teams per year win 20 games. Okay, so you go to Michigan State. What is Tom Izzo like to work for? And look, obviously you're not going to say anything bad about your boss. All I can tell you is, guys generally, your staff, you two haven't left, and it's not for lack of opportunities, so he must be pretty damn good to work for. What is he like?
Everybody, it's funny. When I'm on the road, get to know somebody, talk to somebody maybe just met from another program. What's it like? What's it like working for his? Oh, he's the best, I say, are you kidding me? Or they say, do you love it? Do you love it, Dane? He said, are you kidding me? It's hard. Love it. Winning. I love winning. All right. But coming into work every day, it's hard work. I don't know if love's the right word, but I'll tell you this, Doug. I love him, and he makes me better every single day. And, I was looking at a job last year. and it paid more. It was, I wouldn't call it a lateral move, but it's hard to make a lateral move from a program like this and a boss like this. But I said, I don't want to go. I said, I just want to know that you bring value, or I'm sorry, I just want to know that I'm still, that you think I'm still bringing value to your program, and that I'm still making your program better. And, you know, he obviously told me yes because I stayed, but it's every day that I feel I get better. And I just told somebody that this morning. You know, why not take a certain job or go after a certain job that's open? And I said, you know, it would take a lot to get me to leave, and mainly because I'm still getting better. I'm still learning here in a major way, and hard to work for. But here's the thing about Coach Izzo. What he says he's going to do, he's going to do. And at no point, even in his worst day, even when he's told me, you know, I've done something wrong or done a bad job, or he's disappointed at, or yells at me or tells me to look for another job at the end of the year, at no point do I not think that he doesn't have my best interest in mind. I know at all times that whatever he does, it's for my best interest, much like a player. But I've just never been around a guy that's more selfless than him. And we can talk about him making big money and all that. You know what? He's had chances to triple that and put less time in the NBA. And so we're in a situation right now in college basketball that there is not a better leader. And I am going to stroke my boss for a second. There's not a better leader/CEO out there than Coach Izzo, because he gets the most out of you. And yet he does it out of love. And we can talk about him getting in people's faces, but him doing that to somebody is different than, say, me or you doing that to somebody, because of the amount of love and time and passion and work that he puts into each individual player and coach and person. You know, this is a guy that grew up in a really small Upper Peninsula town, poor town. He was poor. His dad owned a shoe repair shop, and he was in there working. And if five people came in to spend money that day, Doug, you needed them to spend money. So you had to learn to treat people like $1 million and be genuine about it. And so this is just a larger shoe repair shop. Honestly, I've just never been around anybody that's as passionate and caring about others as this guy, as Coach Izzo, in his position.
Right.
He doesn't have to be. He doesn't have to coach. He doesn't have to put up with stuff. He could go to the NBA. He could retire. It's just an incredible time, and the book hasn't been written, and I'm surprised why it has. You can make a lot of money writing a book on this guy. Where's Feinstein?
I actually ran into the Final Four, but do you want him have him write? I could write it. Okay, so I got a couple more.
Sure.
Because I want to talk about this year's team, but first I want to ask him. This is in regards to this year's team. He has certain things that he does, right? He'd always, you know, come over, call a timeout here, end of game situations, things you guys prepare for. But yep. What I've noticed is he started some of it last year, but really this year especially, and the team had some limitations, but I've noticed kind of a bit of an evolution in some of the stuff you guys run. Like, if you go back a couple years ago when I was at CBS, like, it was the same plays and sets and maybe even calls you guys had run forever, right? Mm-hmm. Look, you still have your still core. You're still rebounding. You're still transitioning. You know, you guys are still running the lane super hard and super wide. You guys still rebound like wild dogs. But the actual sets offensively have evolved. There's some NBA looks. There's some ball screens that are to the baseline side. There's some different stuff. Who's the guy in the staff that convinced him to change?
Well, I'm sure there's a bunch of people, but I guess from my perspective, my approach with Coach was, you know, he's best friends with the late Flip Saunders, loves Flip. And Flip would always come every summer and chalk talk, and Coach would always, since I've been here, would always hear Coach talk about, you know, flipping his counters. Like, that's a good point, Coach. Why do you say flipping his counters? It's just, you know, like, shouldn't we have counters to a set? Thinking, why doesn't he like counters? And so he wasn't real big on counters per se, you know, counter plays. So if you run a pin down and they go underneath the pin down, we call it a fade.
Right.
Just script it. You know, just, all right, Travis Trice, you're coming off a fade because you're going up the gut. Counter. More motion principles, more reads. But after last year, we lost to Syracuse. Now, there's a million reasons why, but you don't want to hear any of them. But
we can talk about it.
I just thought, all right. I have my own thoughts. Some things that we need to change, okay? And I went down my list of things that we needed work on, of course, naturally, end of the season. But I just got to thinking, you know, today's player, all right, forget about the personality, the toughness, all that stuff. We can sort through that. But today's player, especially the young kids, are taught so much with the ball in their hands, okay? Yep. And Miles Bridges is an example.
We just had this. I just had this discussion with a coach, but go ahead.
If you watch Miles play in college, okay, damn good. All those things, good at what he's good at. But one of the things he had no idea how to do when we got him was play without the basketball.
Right. That takes time.
And so I said, we're pounding a square peg through a round hole trying to teach these guys how to move and cut, teach them all these principles how to play without the ball. And that's great. We should, and we should never stop. But I said, we've got to start putting them in positions, A, that they're good at, and B, you know, allowing them to, not allowing them, but catering to, you know, what each player can do well. And so I said, in addition, you know, one of our biggest sells is that we are running an NBA style offense, and yet the NBA seemingly has moved a little bit, and we've, as you kind of alluded to, we've stayed the same.
Right.
And so we have guys like Miles Bridges and Jaren Jackson, that, A, they're young, incredibly young, 17, 18, and B, really don't know how to play without the ball. Jaren was better than Miles, but that's a lot to ask, considering we are so young. And so the recruiting philosophy, I think, needs to change, our recruiting philosophy. It's hard to survive with a couple one-and-dones.
Yep.
You either got to go all in my opinion, or really, really limit your one-and-dones. But B, we either recruit kids that know how to play without the ball, which is really hard to find, or recruit the best talent that we think fits our program, the best profile that fits our program. And you never know until they get here. But what we do know is the guru generation, the trainer generation,
mm-hmm.
you know, the kids that don't go play 5-on-5 mm-hmm. out in the park or at, you know,
Coach, I call it I call it one on cone generation.
There you go. That's right. We've got some amazing. I that's what I sell the recruits. It's funny. Look, I can put you through the best cone drills you'll ever see. You know, as good as anybody, as good as the best in the country, I can set up cones. Okay, but you know, the one thing you're going to get here is this, this, and this. Chance to play for a right. championship, chance to play for a Hall of Famer, and you'll be pushed. But that was my, that was, I know that was a long answer, but, you know, that was my thought is we've got to do a better job of putting our players in position to play to their strengths in real time. You know, and they'll evolve, they'll develop. We believe in versatility, and then the counters. All right. So if they go start trapping Cassius's ball screen, let's not go away from okay. Can't set a ball screen for Cassius. Let's use it against him. You know, let's let him trap Cash and put our guys in position to where now we're going to punish him. You know, if they start turning, if they start playing on top of a down screen, let's not go away from the down screen. Let's use it against them. And so those were the adjustments that were my suggestions. And Coach is awesome. Coach Izzo's the best in listening. He may not agree with it, but he's definitely going to listen.
So how did in now that you've had a chance to decompress, you guys had an amazing year, right? Like, not just you lose two lottery picks and you win your tournament in Vegas, you win the Big Ten, you win the Big Ten tournament, you get to a Final Four, right? Like, of things that can be checked, you checked every box except for one, which is win a national championship, right? I mean, that's an incredible season. And then you factor in all the injuries, right? Like, I think if you had Arns, I think you might go to a national championship game. You know, forget about if you had... if you had Langford. But, and I remember I was sitting across from Steve Lavin and we did this, it was before one of your games early in the season. Mm-hmm. And I picked you guys to win the Big Ten. And I said, no agendas. I was like, this is going to be a great college basketball team. Cause I'd seen you in Vegas, whatever. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But how, now that you've had a chance to kind of decompress and think about it, how did it come to be that you guys had this type of year, considering all of the different things which could have caused it to go south?
Well, I think what we did is we knew going in that Xavier Tillman was going to be a great player for us. Okay, he was having a great summer, changed his body, and he just has an unbelievable feel for the game. And so we knew that Tillman was really going to help us. He is. We use the term Draymond-like. He's Draymond-like on defense in that he makes up for a lot of mistakes that other players make. And we knew we had a bunch of really good pieces, but the one thing we couldn't really factor is we didn't know who was... We needed people to step up, so we felt like Tillman was going to step up. We felt like obviously, Langford was going to be better. We weren't sure on McQuaid or Kenny Goings, and those guys stepped up in a major way. We knew Matt was going to be a great defender. Okay, Matt's one of the best in the country. But he just was so much more confident on offense, and I think part of that was that Josh Langford got hurt and Matt didn't feel the... you know, didn't feel the guilt maybe that it was his time to make a play or shoot when he knew he had another elite player next to him. You know, Nick Ward getting hurt was devastating, but it also helped other guys gain confidence and get better. Cassius Winston, you know, when Josh went down, that was our third scorer. You know, you had Cassius Winston, Nick Ward, and Josh Langford, we felt were going to do the bulk of our scoring. So then it forced us to be a little bit more creative with Cassius. And there were times in games where maybe I would be calling something for another player to at least get the ball, and it was, nope, we're ball screening for Cash. Give Cash space, he'll make a play. And so I think that when it's all said and done, how did we hang on and keep getting better? I'll give coaching some credit. I'll give culture a lot of credit. But I think in the end, the players bought into what we were doing, Doug, and that is hard to do, especially when you've got McDonald's All-Americans, kids that had a ton of success, kids that are driven to be pros. They bought into what we were doing. I'd say you're right. If we had Kyle Arns, we probably would have played in that championship game, and that's not to take anything away from Texas Tech, but that experienced player would make a huge difference, because when Aaron Henry got in foul trouble in the first half of that semifinal game, we felt like we could play six and a half guys, and the half was going to spell, was going to give McQuaid a 1 or 2 minute break and maybe Cassius a 1 or 2. We couldn't give McQuaid a break, and I think it wore McQuaid out. And I will give Matt McQuaid credit, or Texas Tech credit, for that. Could we have played Aaron Henry with two fouls in the first half? Yeah, but that's not really what we do. And we felt like as long as we were close in the game, we didn't need to play him. But maybe that's for another day.
No, listen, I mean, I generally would disagree with that philosophy. I thought it nearly got that same thought hurt Virginia when they took Diakite out with two fouls. And then, heck, in he took Ty Jerome out with four fouls with 5 minutes to go against Auburn. And Ty Jerome has never fouled out of a game. He only had four fouls one other game this year. You know, they don't foul, or they don't actually, they're like Michigan. They don't get called for fouls.
Yeah.
they don't foul.
Well, you know, Coach K put Zion back in our game, and he had two fouls.
Yeah. Listen, I think it's very much case dependent. And I played for a guy who would sit there and go like, well, coach, do you want to leave him in, or do you want to take him out? Like, you get five, stop fouling. That's what he,
Oh, the old war horse.
Yes, it was a very simple philosophy. You stop fouling or come sit next to me and help me coach. You're like, all right, okay, guess moving on. But
beautiful.
Hey, listen, it was an incredible, incredible year. But you know what? One last thing on I want to do on Coach Knight, because
hey, I got time.
No, I know, but in terms of a podcast, you don't want it to, because people will download it more if it's a little bit, you know.
Well, you can splice it up, right?
I could splice it up. I don't know if you're worthy of two pods. I don't know that.
No, I was saying you can cut some stuff out.
I don't want to cut anything out. It's been freaking good.
You can put late and late night and have me put some people to sleep.
What, you know, like he was on campus last week. Obviously, he made an appearance, and obviously, he's got some memory issues that's working. What I feel bad, look, I'm part of the Coach Sutton family. I feel terrible that the image that people have of him now is, you know, in a wheelchair and unable to feel what it was like, and people are right. And am I crazy? But you guys playing against Texas Tech, like. There was a lot of Bob Knight in how Texas Tech played, how they competed. You mentioned the defense, in the motion in the offense, right? Like, if you were to relay, hey, man, I can't tell you exactly what it would be like if Coach Knight was in his prime, but a lot of what it might have looked like was what Texas Tech was like, no?
You know what? With the players they had men, and they had men that were willing to, you know, lay down their bodies for the betterment of the team. And I was just fascinated with that their motion, and they didn't run a ton of it against us.
No.
But I give Coach Beard all the credit, especially with
they got tired, by the way, guarding you guys. And so they stopped moving. They kind of stopped running. When you guys made that run the second half, they were gassed.
They were tired. Yeah, they were. They were, and I think that, you know, obviously Owens gets hurt with his ankle against us, and that's nobody's fault, and it's awful to see it happen, but I think it impacted him for the next game too, you know, against Virginia. And I think that, you know, we did a number on them as they did a number on us, but I think whichever team made it through to Virginia was going to have a tough, tough game, for the simple fact that the two teams that played in the second game on Saturday night, it was a war. And, you know, back to the Coach Knight, Coach Beard. It's interesting that anybody who runs motion today is, you know, I feel for them, but I admire them. But their toughness, you know, it did. It reminded me of, you know, those Coach Knight's first team. You know, he always talks the first championship team with Quinn Buckner and Scott May and those guys. It was a tough, rugged, blue collar to 1-5 team.
Yep.
And I think that, you know, if you get a chance to ask Coach Izzo, I think he'll readily admit that that team was tough, if not tougher than us, especially in that game.
Yeah, and that rarely happens. Then Moody made some shots. They just, you know, they made some shots, and, you know, playing from behind. And playing from behind is hard. It's just, you know, so much better to.
And we had our chance. We did.
Yep. No, I mean, yes, you had it. You had a run. You had them within grasp. They. I talked to those guys afterwards. I was like, you guys stopped running offense. Like, dude, we were tired. Guarding them is hard.
Yeah, it's funny because, and I mentioned McQuaid being exhausted. You know, that shot he gets in the corner from Aaron Henry.
Yep.
Okay. Late in the game, he makes that 9.5 times out of 10. But I think that Henry getting in foul trouble really hurt us. They're not playing Aaron by any sense. Just McQuaid makes that shot 9.5 times out of 10. And he missed it to tie the game. Tillman gets the ball stolen with, we're down 4.5 minutes. Hey, those guys did a number on us, too. It was a great game. Probably not from a fan's perspective, but
I disagree. I was sitting there watching. I thought it was like watching three prize fights. It was fantastic.
Yeah, basketball. But you're a coach. I don't consider you a fan. You're a coach.
I'm not a coach. I don't have a team.
You don't have a team?
I have like 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th high school teams. That shit doesn't not compared to what you guys have. Listen. You've been more than gracious with your time, and I think people at this point, if they've listened this long, they're like, man, these guys could go on and on. We will do a part two at some point this summer, we'll talk more about Izzo, and I love the stuff about the brain and the mentality. In the meantime, congratulations on an incredible season. Incredible season.
Doug Dugan, I appreciate it.
I would love to be Dugan. I'm just such a much cooler name than Doug. Thanks for joining
Eric.
Yes. Thanks for joining me. All right. So that my thanks to Dane Fife and to Tony Bennett. Virginia's our national champion. And look, with all of the mess that has been college basketball, the perception of college basketball, to have Virginia win it, where you got legit student athletes and a coach that doesn't cheat and somebody who has just the great balance of having been beaten by Syracuse when they should have gone to the Final Four, or by UMBC when they were upset the year before, to then have these miraculous 3 wins in a row and win a national championship and doing things the right way, I think is great for the sport. We'll do more recaps on the year. We'll have more coaches on. We'll turn our focus more also to the NBA upcoming. I really appreciate you downloading, subscribing, and rating the All Ball Podcast. Remember to check out the radio show, Doug Gottlieb Show, daily 3 to 6 Eastern Time, 12 to 3 Pacific, on Fox Sports Radio, foxsportsradio.com, the iHeartRadio app as well. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball.